So, welcome back to Ficthripology, our lovely podcast about all things fanfic and all things critical about fanfic. And we have our usual contingent of people. That's Elanya
Hello.
and Neri
Hello.
and Aeris.
Hello.
And then there's me, Luconi. And I guess we'll get started with our latest article. Who wants to go introduce our book?
I'll do it. All right. So the article that we're reading is from a book called Fan Fiction and Fan Communities in the Age of the Internet, New Essays, edited by Karen Helixson, or yeah, Helixson and Christina Busi. And this book came out in 2006, and it contains a number of different articles on various aspects of fan fiction, of which we have selected one, which is coincidentally the first article in the book, but that was just coincidental, I swear.
Yes, we won't make you go through every single one of them.
No.
Although there are
No.
some c a couple others that would be good to read.
We could read them in concert with something else.
Yeah.
Okay, so who's going to talk about the chapter we've selected?
I'll do it.
Okie dokie. You're the one who found it, so that makes sense if you introduce it to us.
All right. Well, the chapter that we're reading is called Archontic Literature: A Definition, a History, and Several Theories of Fan Fiction by Abigail Derrico. And we came across it because we were discussing the term archontic during our last literature, during our discussion of other sorts of terminology, let's say, for fan fiction. And this chapter is really useful because it lays out say a critical theory of fan fiction as a genre, let's say, which dovetails nicely with what we were talking about in our last podcast, where I think the question of whether or not we can call fan fiction a genre was raised and not answered.
We don't have to answer anything, do we?
No, we don't have to answer anything. In fact,
Phew.
I feel like answering will solidify everything and
Oh,
take us
wait a
away from
minute.
chaos.
You're jumping ahead.
I am jumping ahead. But she essentially links up fan fiction as a type of archontic literature, which she defines and then gives a history and then links up with fan fiction. So, there goes archontic literature. A definition, a history, and several theories of fan fiction.
Okay. So the archontic terminology she says is related to archive. And she looks at the whole thing as an archive. I have issues because I keep thinking of archon like the Greek word for king or ruler, and so then I just keep thinking patriarchy. But
Which is ironic,
yes.
given her conception of this.
Yeah.
This is also, we should probably mention that the term archontic relating to the word archive is something that she's taking from Jacques Derrida's 1995 work Archive Fever. So that's the source and the sort of the concept that she's working with here. And then
Right.
she gives a quote talking about what archives do in his conception, that is, by incorporating the knowledge deployed in reference to it, the archive augments itself, engrosses itself, it gains in auctoritas, but in the same stroke it loses the absolute and metatextual authority it might claim to have. When we'll never be able to objectivize it with no remainder, the archivist produces more archive, and that is why the archive is never closed. It opens out of the future. And so that's the concept that she's taken from Derrida and is trying to apply to fan fiction and to sort of other works that are inspired by other texts, we'll say.
Right. Well, and she's trying to distinguish it from like the term appropriative literature, which I believe Jenkins used,
Yes.
which makes it sound less legitimate and more like you've stolen it, and this is more like you're participating in the overall knowledge of this
I don't,
work or something.
yeah, sort of. She's trying to get away from terminology that associates a relationship of primacy to the original text that gives it more power,
Yes.
I think is what she's trying to do.
Right.
And so
Absolutely.
it's hard to describe, you know, what she's doing without using, you know, without talking about there being an original text and without that having meaning, without saying...
Well, which is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because critical theory is on some level all about trying to understand the relation between, you know, various manuscripts of the text with the idea of let's go back to the oldest, the original. I mean, that's how critical theory came about.
Right.
Right? Which manuscript, which version of the Bible is the closest to, you know, what was actually written down by our original authors. And it's evolved into this place where we're like, well, there's no such thing as an original text, or it shouldn't have the stature that it does.
Right. But I don't know if I entirely agree with that, but...
I mean, I guess I would say, speaking as an archivist...
Right!
that, I'm not sure I agree with the definition that no archive is ever final, complete, or closed.
I was wondering about that.
Because I've seen some that are basically final, complete, and closed, and I don't think anyone's ever going to use them again.
Right.
But, you know, I guess it's theoretically possible that someone always could, as long as it continues to exist as an archive. But that's the thing, is you can dissolve an archive. You can split it up and sell off the component parts, and it's
right.
No longer an archive anymore.
Well, I've kind of thought of that as sort of the dead fandom that nobody contributes to anymore and then disappears and everyone forgets about it. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, I think that's probably an accurate analogy. And the other thing is that I do think that archives at least tend to think of themselves as having that authority of primacy, or of, you know, we are the source of your knowledge, you come to us to find out things that you will then use in your secondary sources, kind of thing. And the very idea of a primary and a secondary source, I mean, that's
right.
Inherently implying some sort of hierarchy, not necessarily of a, you know, this is better than this, or this is, you know, more valuable than this or whatever, but just that one comes before the other.
Right.
And I think that that is something you really can't get away from.
Well, and I was wondering, too, when she said, you know, that everything sort of has essentially equal status in an archive, but don't archives sort of choose what they're going to accept?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, it's not quite like, and we're just going to toss all these papers in here, whether we need them or not.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there's weeding, there's deselection, there's, you know, accessioning or not accessioning things that come in. You know, you pick and choose.
Right.
And I suppose that can happen in fandoms to some extent, too, if it's sort of, if there is an archive, you know, whoever runs that archive may have control over what actually gets posted there or preserved there, but...
Right.
For example, Luconi was talking before we actually started our podcast about Bonanza archives, and, you know, how the people who run them are... You know, they have certain values and they have certain sorts of things that they don't want to see included in the stories that they will post on those archives, or that they will host on those archives.
Right. Yeah, they're very selective.
Yeah. And so the other types of stories may exist, but they're not included in that sort of official forum or grouping of literature.
Right.
So I guess the question then becomes, when we talk about the archive, are we talking about the physical or the official, whether it's a library or a collection or AO3, or are we talking about a larger archive, right? Something that maybe is a little more abstract.
Well, it seems like for her metaphor, she uses a lot of comparisons to an actual physical real archive, but I think for her the fanfic archive that she's talking about is like any story ever written anywhere, or fanvid or whatever, all counts as part of the archive for that fandom, I guess. I think she would group it by fandom still, though, right?
Sort of. It's her conception, I found, is not very consistent. Because she talks in some places, she says that, you know, texts are archival in nature. So she wants to give the same properties that she gives archives, you know, where they are constantly growing, and they enlarge themselves. She wants to give that to the texts themselves. But then she says specifically that a text is not an archive also.
Yeah, it's the virtual construct surrounding the text, including it and all texts related to it.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting.
it's interesting, but like,
doesn't make.
I do. It did seem to me like she wasn't using her concepts consistently in some places.
Yeah, and I think some, she abandons some that
yes.
I was hoping that she'd pick up. For example, when she talks about this archontic principle that Derrida lays out, which spoke to me more than the concept of the archive.
Right.
The archontic principle gathers the functions of unification, of identification, and of classification. What is the basis of? It's the internal drive of an archive to continually expand. And this, I do think, has value when you apply it to fandom.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's this outward push
mm-hmm.
that occurs. Whether you're talking about, say, a comment thread that just keeps going, or
a kink meme.
Or a kink meme, exactly, or a WIP, or when fandoms run into each other.
Right.
And you know, I'm on Tumblr now, and Tumblr is like a scrapbook on speed.
Yeah.
One could definitely look at this idea of, you know, unification, of classification, of gathering together, and apply that to the sort of fanish behavior that occurs on Tumblr.
Yeah.
I sort of wish she'd brought that through, especially when she starts talking in the end about these ideas of repetition.
Yeah, it seems to me like she was really trying to do two things with this article, and they didn't dovetail as nicely as she was hoping to do. So mm-hmm. she's presenting this concept of fan fiction as archontic literature, where the texts that are created have generative powers themselves, and they are not necessarily subservient or derivative is another word that she's trying to get away from of the original material, that they add to it, they complement it, mm-hmm. and then they increase the broader archive or text or however. She goes back and forth on how that works exactly. I think that relationship is not especially clear.
Mm-hmm.
That they sort of enlarge each other and they continue to expand. And so that's one concept that she's trying to get across, and she's trying to develop, you know, that relationship between this concept and fan fiction and explain how fan fiction works in this way. And then the other big part of her article is she's trying to, she presents this history of fan fiction and archontic literature, and she starts in the 17th century with women writers who are basically writing, she calls them sequels, and she but also applies the concept of archontic literature, where they're writing stories that come from other stories mm-hmm. that were written by men. And she's mm-hmm. saying that these are some of the first published women authors in England.
Yeah, that struck me as strange.
Yes,
and wrong.
Yes, it is. It's very arbitrary.
She's right for the really narrow definition she's taking, which is like the first prose fiction published by a woman in English. Like it's a really narrow definition of women's writing.
Right.
There's a much longer, obviously much longer tradition of women's writing than going back to the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
But
and published women's writing.
Yes, absolutely. But for prose and for fiction,
and in English,
you know, and in English, and knowing that it was written by a woman,
right?
Yes, that's
it. Had a woman's name attached to it. For that really narrow definition of what women's writing is, then she is accurate that Mary Roth was like the first known female writer to write original prose fiction in English. But
right.
Yeah, I just find that a very narrow way of looking at women's writing. If you're excluding, you know, poetry, and you're excluding biography, and you're excluding
religious writings,
and yeah. you're excluding lots of things, basically.
And you're excluding oral
yeah.
traditions, which struck me as strange because I see the processes of sort of fandom as being strongly oral. We may not necessarily speak our stories, but the sort of face-to-face between fans is, on some level, a retelling. And then the way that people adopt certain formulas and then use those formulas, you know, shifting them slightly as you write one fic and then another and another, that, you know, reminds me of oral poetry, whether you're talking about, you know, Homer or the Corridos of of the sort of the Rio area.
Right. And she does touch on the fact that this sort of this archontic concept of these sorts of retellings does go back a lot further, obviously. And she talks about, you know, it being used, you know, people retelling myths politically and for specific political reasons. She touches on that concept, but
it just makes her decision to plop us down in the middle of the 17th century seem all that more arbitrary.
Well, it's perfectly arbitrary, but she has a reason for doing that, in that she's trying to use, she's trying to say that archontic literature, and that the project of creating archontic literature specifically in terms of written fiction is a project that is often undertaken by minority voices.
Mm-hmm.
By marginalized groups or people who can't, you know, find representation otherwise.
Yeah, the literature of the subordinate.
That's why I think that the definition of women's writing is really critical here. And how, I'm not going to argue that women's voices were not suppressed or were not less heard, but there were other women who wrote things.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
in addition to what Neri is saying, that it does, like, it does sort of ignore a lot of other women authors. It also doesn't give context for what these women authors were doing. Like, it just says, oh, also they were writing these archontic texts, and so we don't have an idea from what she's giving us here whether or not they are engaging in a project that is more broadly accepted in the literary world of 17th century Britain, like we don't, or England.
Well, one of them was written in the margins of a book, so that one was not published for other people to read.
And one of them was anonymous.
Yeah, and it's
she chooses to see the anonymous ones as female, which I think is a kind of iffy decision too. Like, you really just don't know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You're saying, well, it would have been transgressive for a woman to write this, therefore I think the anonymous ones are female. But I mean, two of the named ones are female, so...
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
And one of them is male, so...
You know, again, we don't have a context for knowing how much of these kinds of sequel writing was going on.
Right.
To place that information. She doesn't give us that context. And I mean, she makes some interesting points later about how fan fiction as archontic literature is also culturally subversive in the fact that, you know, we're writing against copyrights and so forth. And all of that.
Title 17.
Yeah. But I don't know that she needs to draw that. I'm not convinced by the links of history that she makes, I guess. And I'm not sure that she wouldn't have had two stronger articles if she had focused on either, you know, solidifying fanfiction as an archontic concept or looking at the history once that concept has been established.
Mm.
But I think that she was trying to do too much with this article and the things get lost.
Yeah, I thought that the bit about the 18th century ones, the ones from the Lettre d'une Péruvienne, were really fascinating. Like, I really liked that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's really fascinating because, A, it's a book by a woman in the first place.
Right.
That they have this number of responses to it, like that they know of five different sequels, you know, alternate endings, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
That were written by two women, one man, and two anonymous people who we don't know. And that all of them rewrite the ending to give it a romantic, happy ending. And I thought that was really fascinating, but I also think it undermines her point. her theoretical point of, like, this is literature of resistance, because it's not. I mean, she does acknowledge this too, that it's like you're expressing your dissatisfaction with the novel because it didn't correspond to the values of the dominant sort of patriarchal culture.
And this is not actually, I watched My Fair Lady last night, and this exact process occurred with George Bernard Shaw's play. So George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, which when the play, when he originally wrote it, ends with our female protagonist, Eliza Doolittle, leaving our male protagonist, Henry Higgins, for a minor character, Freddy Eynsford Hill, who is portrayed as kind of a drip. And people really disliked it when they saw the play. I mean, they enjoyed the play very much. It was very, very popular. But they really wanted Eliza and Henry to end up together, even though in the text of the play, it's kind of a this weird partnership where it parodies a marriage in places and is revealed to be deeply flawed. So when they made the movie, the producers just had them write a whole new ending. And when George Bernard Shaw saw it, he was pissed off. And people had been trying to put new endings on the play as well. And in 1916, this prompted Shaw to write a sequel, a short sequel, which is printed at the back of some versions of Pygmalion, where he outlines what happens after the play, how Eliza marries Freddie. And it's not necessarily a marriage of intellectual equals, but they complement each other in other ways. And so they end up being happy together, if not necessarily economically successful. And he has this fantastic little rant about how, you know, in some, you know, relationships, there are dominant personalities and more submissive personalities, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the dominant people always are strong and the submissive people are always weak. And I'm reading this and I'm just like, wow, George Bernard Shaw is amazing. But my love for George Bernard Shaw aside, I thought it was very, very interesting that, I mean, the exact same process happened, that the writers, you know, postulated this ending that went away from the institution of marriage, and the readership just rejected that.
Yeah.
Utterly. And is that subversive? I mean, they're not subversive in a gendered perspective, but from a narrative perspective, they are rejecting authorship, and in the case of George Bernard Shaw, a very, very well-respected author.
Right.
So, I mean, when a whole bunch of people decide to do something, or decide that another way is better, is it necessarily subversive? Right? Is George Bernard Shaw being subversive? Is Graphic Knee being subversive? Or are the people who rewrite their endings to give them give the narrative that they themselves want to see, despite what the author says, are those the people being subversives?
Well, I think that goes a little bit back to what Jenkins was talking about with the
It was like what Jenkins was talking about with the third season of Beauty and the Beast, where people rejected the ending of the romantic plot line and substituted their own, you know, happier endings, basically.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think that there's two different kinds of subversion that we need to look at here, and one is the cultural subversion of the, you know, actual social practices that the original author, I really don't know how else to talk about it. The original
the
author's
primary
originary
source?
Author,
the originary author. There we go. Or primary author, or however you want to say it. That they posit, and then there's a subversion of that authority of the text, and I think that that's really what she's trying to get at here. Is not, or that's the power that she's trying to give, in the case of the letters of a Peruvian woman, that's the power that she's trying to give to the people who are arguing back, is the power to subvert the authority of the text itself, and not so much what they're doing with that power. And that's what she tries to relate later to the sort of the project of fan fiction as being archontic, is this idea that we don't acknowledge the power of that primary text, that we don't grant it that absolute authority to determine, you know, how this story needs to be told.
Except, do we?
I think she also wants it to be subversive of cultural dominant norms,
yes,
of cultural values, and I don't, like, she wants it to be a voice for the people who don't have a voice. She wants it to be subverting post-colonial theory, like talking about, I really liked the part too about Wide Sargasso Sea, which I love. It's a great book,
right?
And it really does, like, force you to reevaluate the, you know, the narrative of Jane Eyre from this perspective of
Bertha.
Of the villain, effectively, of the story. but I think that the Graffigny example is more complicated than that, and to me is more interesting in some ways, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't subvert the dominant, you know, sort of sociocultural values. The original text did that.
Right.
And people rejected it on that ground.
Which you see in fan fiction a lot. Where yes. People...
Sure, absolutely. I mean, fix it fic and people wanting a happy ending. Exactly.
Or even, I mean, a lot has been said about, you know, sort of the fan culture is being subversive and being against mainstream. But I honestly find a lot of mainstream thoughts in fan fiction. You know, even in what one might think of as slash fan fiction, there's a rejection of some of the more subversive stuff that you see in shows in order to help the romance grow.
Right. Well, and I thought she brought in a point from the person who wrote about romance novels themselves, and how the way it's, even though some of these stories end in marriage and the traditional values are supported, she said there's the focus on emotional gratification and nurturance, which is not found in other forms of literature that are more
right.
masculine in origin. And so that in that way, the subordinate voice is coming out and saying, this is what's important to us. This is what we want to see in our literature. And you're not giving it to us, so we're going to write it ourselves. And so it's not that necessarily they don't have to reject the values that they grew up with. I mean, it's hard. You can't really separate all the 100% your values from the society that you grew up with. Like, you can reject certain ones or make certain choices and decide that this doesn't work for you anymore.
Yes.
But you're still influenced by them. Like, the whole, like, what you find beautiful in another person is so ingrained in how you were raised and what culture you were raised in. You can't just decide to turn that off. And so I think when people support certain traditional endings or traditional narrative styles in their writing, it's not all bad or being conformist patriarchal slaves or anything. But I liked her. I liked the fact that she points out that some of this is because you're not finding it in other forms of literature, and that women really do like to have that emotional component to stories that they're not getting in, I don't know, Ian Fleming or something.
Also porn.
Yeah.
That's what I had in my notes on that section. Also porn.
Yes.
Well, porn, yeah.
Yeah, the romance novel has often been sort of a signifier of female, you know, porn.
No, we want real porn.
Porn for women.
Yeah, and I think that actually,
exactly.
She doesn't, I don't think she makes her point strong enough here, and I was trying to keep in mind the concepts that she had introduced earlier when I was reading through this, and so, other than also porn, in my notes on that section, I say, I have that she's, that these kinds of projects are Kontic in the sense that they are filling holes in that story. So you have the primary text, and then in the archive of other texts surrounding it, I guess you have these things that provide aspects that the readers feel are missing. So you have and that emotional gratification is one of those examples.
Right. Right, and then you have the voices of the minority characters or the ignored characters or whatever is another thing that could be missing, depending on the
right.
source material.
And I would like to also, one of her big arguments here, and we haven't been giving page numbers, but I'm looking, a lot of this is on page 72, where she's talking about the emotional gratification and so forth. And then she also, on that page, goes into the What Does Fanfiction Mean? Theories of Archontic Literature section. And she says that Archontic literature is inherently structurally a literature of the subordinate. And that in terms of it's done by and for subordinate groups, or that they've gravitated toward this writing in different periods, and that she wants to claim that this attraction has something to do with the genre of archontic literature is intrinsically against cultures of the dominant. And I think that is utter crap.
Yes.
Right.
And I think that part of the problem with the way that she has presented her history without the context, as I was talking about before, is that she doesn't give us any other examples of archontic literature that don't belong to women and minorities. So of course it's easy for her to make that point, but there's no, I mean, we only have her word to take for it.
Well, I mean, no, but she does even. She skims over them in the first paragraph of the where does fan fiction come from, and she's like, oh yeah, people wrote continuations of Chaucer, and, you know, people wrote continuations of Paradise Lost, but I'm not going to talk about those because they were by men, I guess.
Yes. Right.
Well, she talks a little bit about the Greek plays and stuff, but those were all written by men, like the different versions of myths that the Greeks did, and that, I think, counts.
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing that sort of, if we're going to talk about cultures of the dominant and we're talking about literature, we have to talk about literacy. And when that immediately leads into ideas of class and education. So if you can actually sit down and have the time, right, in the 19th century to write something like this, are you not, on some level, part of the culture of the dominant? Is it at all useful to posit this as this idea of a subordinate? I don't know. It was a little distressing to me, this argument of linking up archontic literature so closely with this idea of subversive or subordinate literature, just because anyone can access it.
Yeah, and I think part of it for me is I know fan fiction is generally held to be a project that is primarily engaged upon by women. Like, fan fiction is a girl's thing. And I mean, I see this everywhere, and I think, I mean, that certainly is true, but that focus on the gender aspect ignores a lot of these similar...
Ignores males who write fan fiction.
It ignores males who write fan fiction, and it ignores the other kinds of creative fan projects that men undertake.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I mean, like, I have friends who have, you know, worked on making complete sequels of video games, from, you know, writing out the plots and designing the characters to actually doing all of the programming to make them functional. Like, these are huge projects, and, you know, just to ignore the fact that men do engage in these sorts of these archontic projects is silly. Like, I don't know, it's problematic to me. Like, to completely... I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that there are different ways that men and women engage in this sort of fan creativity, but I find a lot of the time that that gets erased, because we sort of see fan fiction as being this bastion of female creativity.
Well, yeah, and I'm not even sure that that's true pre-20th century, when basically your options were a lot more limited in terms of how you could creatively interact with...
Mm-hmm.
You know, a product. You could write about it, or maybe you could, you know, draw a picture or do a painting or something. You're not going to, you know, program a video game, obviously.
Right.
So I think that the you know, women write and men do technical things division is a much more recent occurrence within fan culture.
Right.
I mean, you kind of need to have a fan culture before you have that division.
Right.
But even if you look at who is presented as fans in the media, something I find interesting is that I see men overwhelmingly being presented as fans in media, and definitely engaging with fan culture, whether it's cosplay or attending cons or discussing, you know, intricate theories of, you know, expanding the universes, whether it's learning Klingon or Elvish.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's always men who are pointed out as doing this. Now,
well, even when I was doing research for the podcast about who had done podcasts about fan fiction, like, half of it was men. And I'm like, why is this man hosting mm-hmm. this podcast about fan fiction? Not that you can't, but it was weird that there were more male voices than female voices. Mm-hmm. Except not necessarily for people who read podfic, so they record a fic and put it up for everybody else mm-hmm. to listen to. I think a lot of those are women, although I haven't done a really large search. But the ones that were doing analysis mm-hmm. were men.
That's interesting.
So again, the question is why?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, LiveJournal, where I first came across fanfiction, really, LiveJournal, is a predominantly female sphere. I have male, you know, friends on my list, but they are definitely minority.
Right.
And I can only think of a few other men that I know who write fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
As fan fiction, not, you know, they identify as fanfic writers. I mean, I know other men who I would call what they do fan fiction, but they would argue that with me. And men are resistant to it. That's another thing I found.
Well, what are they doing that you say is fanfic and they say isn't?
Sometimes it's songwriting.
Oh.
Right, so blurring the line between, say, filking, and then if you're writing a ballad about something,
uh-huh.
you know, something fanish, to me, that starts going into fan fiction.
Yeah.
And then if you look at a lot of the RPGs that are out there,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
right, then the line becomes even more vague.
Yeah, definitely a lot of online RPGs that are conducted in written form are a lot closer to fiction writing than they are to a game of like a tabletop game or a computer game. You know, you're writing big chunks of story,
mm-hmm. right?
Or if you're, say, compiling a history of, you know, the first age of Middle Earth, right? Yeah. I know men will do that.
Yeah, well, and that goes back to that, like, Twin Peaks, men want to categorize and predict things, which, I mean, is a very broad generalization. That's not always true. But I find that, like, the tendency to, like, make epic catalogs of details from a fandom tends to be a male thing. Not 100%, but... Mm-hmm. Like the Tolkien guides and the...
Yes, very, very male-dominated.
And that Harry Potter, the guy who actually got taken to court over it was the Harry Potter lexicon or whatever it was called.
Oh, right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And there is that group Harry and the Potters. Oh,
there's a bunch of different, actually.
There are a whole bunch of Harry Potter-related bands.
Yes, many of which are male-voiced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then... Again, it comes back to why.
Yeah.
And so do we see what they are doing? I mean, I'm perfectly willing to accept that this is contributing to the archive of, you know...
Yes, let's call it that. I mean...
The body of...
Archontic literature.
Literature, text, archontic material, because it's not even literature necessarily, but,
yes.
About a given subject. But do we consider it subversive then? I don't know. I mean, is it?
I mean, it is. It's subversive in the same way that any of the other fan projects are in the fact that it's, you know,
defying authorship. Yeah.
Right. I think it comes back to what Alanya was saying about there's two different kinds of subversion that are being talked about here, and I think conflated in ways that are not necessarily
exactly
helpful.
Right.
Well, she ends her thing with. She ends saying, fan fiction is philosophically opposed to hierarchy, property, and the dominance of one variant of a series over another variant. And I'm not sure I agree with all of those things, but that's what she's trying to establish.
And then her final line is, fan fiction is an ethical practice, which follows exactly from the quote that Lucchini was giving, which she doesn't provide any support for unless you just... blandly, like, unless you're just willing to completely assume that opposing hierarchy, property, and dominance of one variant over another is ethical, which she gives no context for.
Right.
I thought she was trying to link it up with glissant, where we define ourselves in relation to others instead of seeking out a sort of a static identity, being the only ethical way to... I forget how he says it. So it starts in 74.
Yeah.
So for glissant, the only viable ethics in a world traumatized by humanism that led to colonialism is an attempt to get rid of individualistic identities as such and start defining ourselves and our world through relation. So the idea of these sort of archontic texts as being chaotic, constantly in motion, giving equal parts, sort of like equalizing between, say, the nth iteration and the first iteration.
But I still don't think that happens.
No, I don't think so either. Yeah. And this is my biggest question, is do we privilege canon? Because
yeah,
I do.
I do too.
I mean, and I'm like one of these people who is like, whatever, author's dead, you know. But if I'm going to go and talk about, say, Supernatural, I can't go into talking it with people and only talk about how I see the show, right? Even if I know that the person I'm talking about it with has similar views as me. We're down with Wincest, you know, they're totally into it, and I know we're going to end up talking about that. We still have to triangulate in relation to something, and that something is always the show.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and I think that, too, like, if we didn't give some kind of primacy to the text, the canon, we would just be writing whatever we wanted. We would
right.
be writing original fiction, effectively.
right.
this isn't fan fiction.
And I mean, there's a quote that she gives about when she's talking about relation, where she says, relation requires humans to take responsibility for keeping objects in play. And to me, that brushes on the whole game aspect of fan fiction, and that it's a way to engage mm-hmm. with the text mm-hmm. and play with it. But it's still, you need that text. You can't do it without the text. And you're always going back to that text to look.
Well, with the exception of Ghost Soup.
Yes. Oh, I've been thinking about Ghost Soup. This whole that whole section also made me think a lot about Ghost Soup, where there is no, we introduced it briefly in our last podcast, where it's a fandom that has no canon, but the entire engagement that people have with this canon is with the fandom rather is just bickering. It's complete chaos.
Right, but it's a game about fan fiction in general. Like the yes. text in that case is fan fiction culture.
Yeah.
And it couldn't be played in a vacuum.
No, absolutely not.
Right, you have to have actually read terrible fic, or
right.
you know, seen the way fanon and canon diverge,
and fan wanking, and
to say some of the things they say.
Yes,
yeah, and have observed, you know, yeah, massive drama storms, and to be able to contextualize what's happening, or to make up your own new variants on it.
Right,
right.
Yeah, so I think in that case, the text is fandom, basically.
Right. Yes.
Well, I was also thinking, there's an example I have of Gundam Wing, where I first got into Gundam Wing by reading fan fiction, and I'd never seen it before, and I was like, huh, this sounds interesting. And so I read some stories, I was like, I gotta figure out who these characters are. And then I went and watched the whole show, but like, I couldn't start writing my own fan fiction until I'd seen the whole show.
Yes.
Like, I could read stories and be interested in the characters, and then... if I wanted to proceed any further in the game, as it were, I had to go back and read that whole, or watch all 10 zillion episodes of The Glories of War.
Yes.
And insane robot pilots.
I'm trying to think if I've ever written in a fandom that I didn't actually, you know, engage with the source text of. It's definitely crossed my mind.
Yeah, I can't...
I've certainly read lots of things...
Right.
That I didn't have the original knowledge, the original canon knowledge to appreciate, but I appreciated on the grounds of, like,
mm-hmm.
it's a good story on its own.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I started reading SGA Stargate Atlantis fic before I started watching that show, mm-hmm. mostly just because I didn't have access to the show.
Right.
You know, I didn't get Sci-Fi Channel. So I just started reading the fic, and I was like, well, when it comes out on DVD, I'll get it.
I've certainly also purchased things on the grounds that I've seen good fan fiction for this, and now I want to read it or watch it. Or
yes,
whatever.
Right.
I mean, on some level, my ever growing love for hockey is like that. I mean, it was tied into my hometown team winning the Stanley Cup recently, so so there was also that, and I was like, wait a minute, this is an awesome game. But then as I started seeing Hockey RPF on AO3, being like, wait, this is a way for me to engage with this sport that would make it even more meaningful for me. So Jock ARS and Fan ARS are both satisfied by Hockey RPF.
Right.
But not now, because there's the lockout. And I'm sad forever.
I do think one of the things that we... Maneri said this earlier, and I think, or in reference to Ghost Soup, and I think that in some ways you can, like, if you want to cling to her concept of archontic literature, that you can expand the concept of the text from being just, you know, what people write to the sort of the broader project of fandom. So you're not just, you know, looking at
the accumulation of fan behaviors.
Yeah, the accumulation, not only of behaviors, but of, like, writing tropes, like kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And how that gets disseminated, and it links these different archival projects from different texts. It links them all in different ways into sort of a broader meta,
mm-hmm.
meta archive.
And maybe also the sort of accretion of fanon of mm-hmm. AUs that are written by multiple people that become sort of, you know, this is a widely accepted kind
yeah.
of AU.
The verse.
Yeah.
Like, you might say, this is the verse where, you know, Superman is a woman, and everyone writes in that verse.
Right.
Right. And I like that as a, you know, these are products that create their own products, effectively.
Yes. And I think that sort of relationship of sort of text spawning new text in that is sort of where she wanted to take that the concept of it being archontic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And I think that I agree with that. Like, I think that's definitely not necessarily that it's unique to fan fiction or that only fan fiction can do that, but it is a characteristic of fan fiction that I think, mm-hmm. you know, is worthwhile acknowledging and discussing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, but she's hung up on this property thing too, which I don't.
Well, the property thing really bothers me. Because if you write a fic and then someone claims it as their own, another fan claims it as their own.
Right.
I mean, I've seen this happen before, and
oh yeah,
it's not pretty,
and it's not a no one's cool with it. And then I when she was also talking about this, I kept on going back to Twilight and Fifty
right.
Shades of Grey.
Yeah,
and you know when she's like, "Oh, and fan fiction is ethical," and I'm one of the people who believes that that the Fifty Shades author behaved unethically. In her creation of the Fifty Shades sort of novel and universe, not necessarily in the way she wrote it, but in the way she marketed it and sort of exploited
mm-hmm.
the people who were reading it when it was originally Masters of the Universe or Master of the Universe, and so I
think
it,
she exploited the reader, the original
yeah.
readers.
Yes, I think she did.
In what way?
I think that she essentially built up a fan base. Using this, right? Then self-published and took all her stuff off the internet,
right?
Right, and then used that existent fan base to bump up sales of her self-published novel, which then garnered her attention from, say, let's call it the printing publishers as opposed to the self-publishers. I mean, I'm not sure she didn't do anything illegal, but it still mm-hmm. it feels to me like she acted in bad faith.
Yeah. Well, I guess I read a gay romance once that was based on a fanfic that I'd already read. So I was like, oh, I totally know what that is. That was based on a Hornblower fanfic. But I didn't really hold it against her that she did that. But I think people, because the 50 Shades of Grey is so successful.
I don't know. I'm interested to see where the author comes down on fanfiction. Where I'm interested to see. So as 50 Shades becomes, you know, they're going to make a movie about it and no idea who's going to watch that movie. Not me.
Right.
But the thing that's interesting is how she has... I have not seen her interact with fandom since then.
Mm-hmm.
So it really felt like... But this woman seems to have kind of used and lost, sort of.
Well, it's possible that she has just created a new fandom identity as well.
No, that's entirely possible. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just
I don't know, but the attaching of a monetary value to what is essentially fanfic is something that generally the fanfic community doesn't appreciate because unless it's for charity.
Sure. I mean, I think fandom has its code of ethics, and obviously individual people behave unethically. I mean, people plagiarize or people
mm-hmm.
Publish things that they basically just filed the serial numbers off of, you know, a pre-existing story, and then they're selling it as original fic. I mean, I don't know if that necessarily contradicts her statement that fan fiction is an ethical practice in and of itself, even if individual fans behave
unethically.
Oh
no, I'm sure, but it was just interesting to me when she comes down on this idea of property.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely,
right?
Yeah. And I think this is
the example that springs to my head. I'm like, hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and you'll see all sorts of people. In their little disclaimers that are like, you know, I'm not claiming any of these characters for myself.
Mm-hmm.
They belong to so-and-so. But all the original characters are mine, and don't you dare use them. So, like, it's kind of hypocritical in some of those, I think. But it also shows that people do see that their original contributions to this archive, they feel as is their own property.
Can we jump from here, perhaps? Something that was really strongly in my mind when I was reading through this is the concept of archontic literature versus the concept of transformative works. And we're all involved in we at least all use the archive of our own archive, which is hosted by the Organization for Transformative Works.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yes.
to me, they're obviously related
right.
Concepts. But I think to me, the transformative works concept, I think, works a little better for me. It feels a little bit less convoluted, perhaps, and more...
Less forced,
and also it maintains the relationship between the primary text and the transformative works themselves, without still grant, like, it acknowledges that that one came first and that it is primary and that that's the canon, but it still allows the transformed works to have their own power and their own merit that's not necessarily less than the original.
Right.
So it has that sort of that power dynamic that gets away from the sort of, derivative and secondary, like, nature, that relationship of power that she didn't like. But then I think I like that the concept better, that you are taking what was there and you're transforming it into something new.
Yeah.
And I think it also,
Yeah, I think that speaks to something that she did pull up, which I did like. She pulled out this theme from, I'm going to totally mangle this person's name. Is it Giles Deleuze? Yeah, D-E-L-E-U, page 74.
Oh, yeah.
Deleuze?
Yeah, no idea.
All right, so Deleuze, my old friend.
Deleuze, maybe.
It pretty much is... She pulls us this idea of sort of breaking down the dichotomy of virtual and actual.
Right.
And how fan fiction is this way in which the sort of the possibilities in a text can be made actual.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that.
Yeah, I thought that
image is sort of like every text is almost like a Schrodinger's cat situation.
Right.
It's like a fractal. You can just keep zooming in on it. You can do 500 different variations of the same scene.
Exactly.
You know, and they'll all be different in their own way.
Right.
And then they'll generate their own.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, which again goes back to some of the aspects of fanfiction, and which it does link up with the archontic literature and the transformative.
Yes, and a lot of this stuff made me also think of the remixing projects that I have become, I think, more popular in the past couple of years. At least I have encountered them more in the past maybe 3-4 years.
I would go as far back as 5 or 6.
Yeah,
I definitely remember reading them in college,
but they're still relatively fandom new, I think.
Yes.
But I'm not an expert fandom historian, but they're still relatively new as far as I'm aware. But, you know, they're becoming more popular, where you take somebody else's story and rewrite it. You rewrite it from a different character's perspective, or, you know, just change, like, a what if.
Different timeline or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this sort of, this project where fans are starting to sort of to apply, you know, the same tools that they take when they're writing fic about their canon, and then to sort of use it on other fic,
right?
Which I find is really interesting. And it's very transformative in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. In some ways, I think I see that as more transformative than a lot of sort of more traditional fanfic, where you're taking the canon and then maybe doing a missing scene or, you know, an epilogue, like post-canon kind of story, or a pre-canon story. Like, those are adding, but I don't necessarily see that they're actually transforming.
Right.
What is originally given. I mean, obviously there are fanfics that can transform what's originally provided. You know, you can have a...
Yeah, sometimes people end up as bull dancers in Crete.
Exactly. I mean, obviously there can
We're
be...
We're still reading that. We're still going to do that one.
Yeah, obviously some transformations can be so radical that it's almost unrecognizable unless you know the characters and you can say, oh yeah, you know, this is that person. It's still...
Well, we talked about this last time.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know...
Fandom is a shorthand.
Yeah, there are character signifiers that stay the same, but then...
Right.
Everything else is fair game.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is I don't necessarily see a lot of other fan fiction as inherently transformative. I see it as additive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it depends on whether or not what you're conceiving as being transformed. Because, I mean, even if I'm just writing, you know, if I take... pick a random procedural. If I take CSI, right, and I just write another episode of CSI, there's still a transformation in that broader, like, in the canon. Like, you're still, adding is still changing, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Right. I can see that.
I mean, I agree that a project like remixing or like creating an AU or so forth is a lot more transformative than that. But, you know, saying, writing Slash, for example, and transforming the prescribed genders of the character, or not, sexual orientations of the characters is transformative also.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so. It can include, it helps, it's a term that can include other media well, like fan
right.
vids and things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're writing a fan fiction about NCIS or CSI or whatever you were writing your imaginary fan fiction of, I mean, that's a television show, which when you write is then going to be a written story.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it's processed, you know, even if you're writing a fan fiction, say, based on Game of Thrones, you know, in one case you're reading it as a book, and in another case you're reading it as a short story or fan fiction. I don't know. I don't necessarily think that just because it doesn't significantly transform aspects of the story doesn't mean it isn't transformative. I mean, I understand, Mary, where you're coming from on that point, but I guess it's more like anything you add is going to shift let's call the center of gravity of the archive. We can go back to the idea of the archive. Mm. Just a little. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that does transform things. I mean, different interpretations of characters show up, different, you know, even when you're writing a television show and there are multiple writers writing, and they'll, you know, one person may spearhead one episode and choose to focus on one aspect of the character's personalities. And then the very next week, another person spearheads that episode, and a totally different aspect of that character's personality is highlighted. So there, even within the show itself, there's a transformation occurring, although, you know, it's not as transformative as, say, remixing or doing an alternative universe.
Right. It does. I think I agree that it's less confusing than the archontic term. The transformative works is a little more straightforward and, I don't know, useful.
Yeah, I definitely agree that it's a term that is going to be more accessible to more people and is not going to require them to have read Derrida to grasp it
right.
necessarily. So,
yeah, no, I know introducing more terminology to discuss fan fiction is not number one on my list of things that needs to be done.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I like the term transformative work, and I think it has validity, like, as you said, in terms of getting away from the idea of primacy or of, you know, this is the real text and this is the, you know, fake one or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This is the crazy person text.
Yes.
I think the other reason that they chose the transformative work terminology is also for legal perspective, like for a legal purpose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because if you take that concept, and that gives them more leverage when they're arguing against copyright infringement.
Right.
Yes.
And that is something that the Transformative Works organization does.
Yeah.
Is that they will explicitly help people who are, you know, getting embroiled in these copyright issues.
Good point. Very true.
So, and I think that, you know, if you can make that argument that we are not stealing these characters, that my version of these characters is different than yours in some way, that, you know, this is not your text, these are, you know, I have changed these characters to make them into what I want them to be, or what they need to be for my story, mm-hmm. you know, with, you know, reference to that canon and so forth, it gives them a stronger legal standing too.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Which again helps them argue against that whole property issue that
right.
Derecho is talking about. So if we want to accept her premise that fan fiction is ethical, it gives us more tools, I think, than just talking about it as our content.
Well, and then you get back to her idea of the subordinate group mm-hmm. being the group that is not the multimedia corporation that has all the money and the power and the mm-hmm. law, that they're just the ordinary schmoes who feel like expressing their voice, which I thought was an interesting way to look at fan fiction writers as a subordinated group all together, just because they mm-hmm. don't have that power, the economic power.
Right.
Except that, well, what's funny is that I think we're getting to a point where on some level we are being seen as a type of economic power.
Yeah, we are now.
I'm not saying it's necessarily a good thing, it's exploitable economic power, but as the fourth wall of fandom vanishes, if it hasn't already, and fans become visible to the producers of of the text that we consume.
Right.
Mm. Who knows? It's...
Yeah, there's definitely more of a back and forth relation than just we are creating the canon and you're going to receive it and purchase it,
right?
Preferably. Then you know there's more like give and take, I guess. At least I'm perceiving that more, that fans have more of a voice in terms of, I mean, like you were talking about the incident, the case with Teen Wolf.
That is crazy. Like,
yeah.
Yes, explain for the viewers at home and also me.
So in Teen Wolf, the breakout ship, as usually happens, is two characters who do not actually share that much screen time. The main character's best friend, Styles, and then kind of the alpha werewolf, Derek. And mm-hmm. when you combine Styles and Derek, you get Steric, which is the name of this pairing. And Steric became wildly, wildly popular in the fandom. It's actually quite hard to find fic that's not, on some level, Steric. And it has permeated all aspects of the fandom in a way that I've never seen before. And these fan are on Tumblr, and they're on Twitter, and they are not shutting up about Steric. And, you know, I feel like an old lady in this fandom, because the first fandom I was really in was Smallville, where the producers actively hated Clex. They sort of accidentally had it in the show, and then they're like, wait, we have to stop this. Whereas in the case of the producers of Teen Wolf, they are playing it up. And they keep dropping hints that maybe they'll do something about it, and they interact with the fans about it. And there was this huge campaign called Cookies for Steric, where a bunch of fen pooled their resources and essentially sent a ton of cookies to the set with like photographs of the actors on the cookies. So if you were like, if you were this character, you received a box of cookies with your face on them.
That's not creepy at all.
Well, and it came from a Twitter conversation where one fan tweeted the creator of the show and was like, oh man, if you make Steric a real thing, I'll give you my firstborn. And the creator of the show tweeted back and said, babies are messy, send me cookies instead. So fandom sent him boxes and boxes of cookies. And so now everyone on the show knows what Steric is. And they keep dropping hints or trolling us, who knows what they're doing, about potentially hooking up these two characters.
Right.
It's kind of crazy.
But then how much of that is exploitation on the producer's part to get more interest, and how much of it is...
Yeah, it's...
Well, that's the question.
I'm wondering if it's an extension of what they were talking about in Jenkins, what he was talking about, how you have that Hollywood formula where you can't let the characters get together because it would, you know, ruin that
right.
unresolved sexual tension, like relationship angst that keeps people watching.
But even if they are acknowledging that there's UST between these two male characters, that's a step for, that's like a totally different ball game than the producers trying to quash it or ignoring it or pretending like it doesn't exist.
Right, that's true.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. I just think that I'm more of the type to suspect them of exploiting that for the same reason, that they're just, you know, instead of we're going to exploit this on camera, we can exploit it off camera and keep the fans super engaged.
Well, they exploit it not in the show. I mean,
they
do exploit it in the show on some level. Because once they became aware of Steric, they started building in Steric moments. And then in the marketing of the show, they have had those actors market the show together, including one amazing video.
Oh, was that the one where they were on the boat where they're sitting on each other's laps and cuddling?
Yeah, they're like cuddling on this boat, and they're like, wake up.
They're like, we're on a ship. Literally.
And they talk to the camera. They're like, we're in a ship.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't disagree that there's an economic component to seeing this as something they can exploit.
Mm.
But the fact that they see that as something they can exploit is just a totally different thing.
But it's more playful and more acceptant of fandom.
Yes.
Instead of seeing this as a sort of a hyper-intense group of people who sort of exist on the margins of their target audience, these Fen have been on some level elevated into not, if not the target audience, then an audience that is targeted.
Yeah, right. That's true.
And not just for marketing purposes or whatever, but being actively engaged.
Not just as sort of like a demographic group, like, you know, we want to appeal to 18 to 25-year-old females or whatever, but like 18 to 25-year-old females,
yes,
think that these characters are hot together. So we're going to do more of that.
Right.
Yes.
I can't believe it took them, like, what, 60 years to figure this out?
Well, but there's also a difference in the market now, because there are so many channels that there are now a zillion shows. And so you're not trying to get 25% of the country to watch your show. You're trying to get a certain number of millions of people to watch your show. And so you have more leeway to not worry about the fact that, you know, these kids' parents aren't watching the show with them. They're watching them by themselves, because they all have different choices. And so, I mean, they're not expecting a huge market, and they want to keep the market that they have. So I think there's a different economic condition going on now than there was, say, when Beauty and the Beast was going on and there was only like four networks.
Right.
Okay. And on that slightly cynical note, it's time for recommendations.
Who wants to start? Yeah.
I'll start.
Okay.
All right.
So my recommendation, which is actually something I wanted to recommend pretty much as soon as the idea of this podcast was floated, is Speranza's Written by the Victors. Written by the Victors is an amazing, amazing fan fiction based on the show Stargate Atlantis, which I love so much because it deals with one of my biggest issues with Stargate Atlantis as a show, which is the fact that the main characters are essentially a colonizing force in this other galaxy, and that concept really isn't talked about on the show.
Right.
It's alluded to, and you can read certain scenes in certain ways, but they're universally portrayed as the good guys who are freeing this other galaxy from this terrible, terrible threat of the Wraith, which, yeah, they're okay, and they do fight the Wraith a lot, but it's an entire galaxy, right?
Right.
They can't be the only heroes in the Pegasus Galaxy. So Stargate Atlantis, written by Speranza, postulates that Atlantis actually secedes from Earth, and it tells the story not through an omniscient narrator, but through 36 flawed narrators, several of whom are actually writing as historians, commenting on the events of the past. So this combines the traditional fan voice of placing something within the voices of the characters on the show with an academic voice. And it's mind-blowing. It was one of these fic that I couldn't stop reading once I started, and it's over 50,000 words.
Mm. You made me read it. It was good.
And it was so seminal for the fandom that it generated not only lots and lots of stories set in that verse and art about that verse, but it was the very first podfic that I ever listened to. And it really is a virtuoso podfic. They got 36 different people to read the different voices.
Cool.
And it's just put together at such a high level. The quality of the production there is just so good. In my opinion, it's a true classic of fandom and should probably be read by definitely anybody who's into the Stargate world or any really of the shows on sci-fi. You'll be able to pick up a lot of the stuff. But even if you're interested in just seeing how good fanfic can get, how ambitious and how successful it can be, Written by the Victors is a great place to look.
Cool. Thank you very much. Anyone else?
I'll go next. I am recommending a story from last Yuletide, Yuletide 2011, and this is Look and Listen by Yahtzee. And it is written as a fanfic from the 1954 movie Rear Window.
Ooh.
And so we talked last time about different kinds of fan fiction that people write, and we were looking at that, you know, where you take the minor characters and you write about them. Well, that's exactly what this fic does for that story. So or for that movie, where the movie is basically about this guy who breaks his leg and he's laid up in his apartment, and he's a photographer, so he just sort of sits around taking pictures and making up stories about the people that he sees in his apartment complex, and then they sort of get involved in trying to figure out, there's this couple that seems to be into something shifty, and there's some domestic violence going on, and stuff starts going weird, and they think that there's a murder, but they're not sure, and so they're sort of trying to put together this picture from, put together the story from what they can see out his rear window. And so this fanfic looks at some of the people that he's watching, and so looks more closely at their lives. It gives them names, it gives them backstories, it gives them, relationships, and, what do they see is going on, how do they relate to each other, what do they think of the main character who's, watching them and taking pictures and so forth, and how do they interpret the story that's told in the movie. Anyway, it's the kind of story that I really like, and it was really well done and really well written and really well executed. So I thought that I would make that my rec. It's been on my potential to rec queue for a while. So.
And it's by Yahtzee.
Yes, Look and Listen by Yahtzee. Okay.
All right, so mine is called Odyssey by Lissa Brown. It's a Bonanza fanfic, and Bonanza fanfic has a tendency to be epically long, and this one's 31,000 words, so not quite as long as ARS's, but it's a lot of, I want to say a lot of fun, but it's really well researched, it's fascinating, and it tells the story of Ben Cartwright, who's the father of the family, who's going back east to his son. The oldest son, Adam, has gone back to college in Boston, which was where he was born, and so Adam has fallen ill, and they think he might die, and so they have sent word to Ben to come back, and so as he journeys back, he keeps going through these places that he had originally come through when Adam was a baby or a little kid, because it took them, for some reason, it took them like 5 years to cross the country, but so he, as he goes through the different towns on the way back to Boston, he has these little stories about traveling west that are awesome, and then you get the grandfather's point of view, because Adam's grandfather is still alive in the story and in Boston, and so he's taking care of Adam while he's sick, and he's hoping that Ben will get there, and then you get this like flashback sort of aspect of his, he reflects on how his relationship with Adam has grown since he moved back to go to college, and how they kind of were a little awkward around each other at first, and then eventually their relationship became more comfortable, and so there's all these little anecdotes about that, and somehow it's all woven together in a way that makes sense and doesn't confuse you, and is full of lots of interesting history tidbits and that sort of thing. So that's what I'm going to recommend. It's very vanilla, as most Bonanza fanfic is, but it's still really nice, and it's kind of a feel-good story, and that one is archived on fanfiction.net. It's for once not on AO3, so there we go. That's mine.
All right, and the story I wanted to rec is by Erin Angels, and it's called Bo Lin, which is basically a smush name for the two characters in the main pairing of the story, which is an Avatar Legend of Korra story. And the pairing is Lin Beifong and Bo Lin. And it's actually a work in progress, which I didn't realize until I went back to look at it today and found it had suddenly 9 more chapters than the last time at it, and was now pushing 80,000 words.
Wow.
So that was cool, because when I looked at it the last time, I think it had like 3 chapters. So I got to read a whole bunch of extra stuff today that I was like, ooh, this is all really cool. It's an older woman, younger man pairing. I mean, big age difference. Like, he's 16, she's 50 sort of pairing. But I think it handles it in a really, I guess, non-skeevy and also realistic and sort of mature way, where the characters feel like they're in character and they feel like they're believable. It's also, I think the reason I started reading it was because it starts kind of as, hot porn, basically. but it develops into, as the author has gone on, has developed a lot more into this whole AU spinning off from events in the series and sort of following some of the events in the series, but sort of not. I mean, it's sort of, you know, going from a divergent point and spinning off from there, basically. And I like a lot of the things that have happened in the more recent chapters, actually, which were sort of unexpected as I was reading them today, where the author gets into a lot more about the politics of the setting, about other characters who we sort of only see glimpses of get a lot more developed, sort of addressing some problematic issues of the canon of, like, are these characters actually behaving in an ethical fashion? You know, who are the good guys here? And, you know, what happens after the events of the canon that we've seen? You know, it doesn't just all get sort of neatly resolved. So the author is able to go and sort of explore more about, you know, what happens to the bad guys, effectively, after they're defeated. I mean, they don't just disappear. So, you know, what are they doing? And yet at the same time, it carries this relationship through as sort of the thread that is binding all the separate chapters together. And I just really enjoy it. I think it's a really interesting exploration of the world and of these characters. And I find it a very sort of, I'm trying to think of what the right word is. It's a very grown-up sort of fan fiction. I believe that this woman is a 50-year-old woman, and she acts like a 50-year-old woman. You know, her knees get sore when they're having sex or whatever. Like, you know, she's not sort of indestructible and awesome all the time. She's allowed to be cranky or old or you know, whatever. Like, and this is fine, and he still thinks she's hot. So I really like that about it. And now I'm just kind of rambling, but I do really like this story, and I have subscribed to it, so I will now get notified about new chapters and not be surprised when I come back to it and find there's, you know, 30,000 or 50,000 more words than the last time I looked.
And I think that is all, and Luconi is having some connection issues, so perhaps I will say thank you for joining us, and of course please remember to look on LiveJournal and DreamWidth for the links to the recommendations that we have made, and we hope to be back with you in a month.
Yay!
Huzzah!